Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon.
Welcome to another edition of News and Views. Thanks for joining us. State lawmakers gave final approval to the state budget this week that makes more cuts to education and human services while opening the door to the privatization of economic development and the Medicaid program. Here to talk about the major themes in the budget and what it means for public schools and the university system is Rand Coble with the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research. Well, Rand, thank you very much for being back with us on News and Views. We appreciate your time.
Well, it's a pleasure always.
Let's jump in. So much to talk about as the session winds down. Let's start with the number one job that lawmakers have to do every year, but especially every 2 years, which is pass a state budget. They have one. Overall, what are your impressions of the spending plan?
People in the education field, whether it's public schools, community colleges, or universities, are going to be disappointed. People who are sort of on the law enforcement side of things might be happy. There's a little bit in there for the three major power centers. The governor got some things. President Pro Tem of the Senate, Phil Berger, got some things. And House Speaker Tom Tillis got some things. But overall, the combination of this and the tax reform bill, I think, raise substantive questions about where we're headed as a state.
And I want to ask you about a couple more specifics in the budget in a moment. But it's interesting that the budget this year, it's still always the story, but it feels a little bit overwhelmed this year by tax reform, abortion, voting restrictions, and a lot of other sort of issues that are swirling at the same time that the budget is passed. And there hasn't been as much discussion about it.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, when you have as many tax changes, that shapes the amount of money you have for the budget first. Second, with 12 straight weeks of Moral Monday demonstrations and 1 week of Thankful Tuesday demonstrations, you know, the budget is sort of like, oh, yeah, we got to do that before we leave. And, you know, I think, too, we forget the cumulative effect of the recession. You've had about 5 years of cuts in budget or flat budgets. And I think at this point, sort of the budget news this year is less dramatic than in previous years.
Yeah, although, as you mentioned earlier, it's not maybe good news for people who support education, at least public education. And I wanted to ask you more about that. For the first time, we'll have a voucher plan in the budget, although I guess it takes effect in 2014. Money's going to private schools. There's expansion of charter schools this session. There's no teacher pay. There's an end to teacher tenure. There really does seem to be a shift in philosophy about education.
Well, I think that's true really across the board, regardless of policy area, whether it's environment or economic development or transportation, tax, budget. But just looking at education, you've got a speed up of vouchers for students to go to private schools, in this case, children with disabilities, probably a broader voucher program next year or in following years. You've also got a huge expansion in charter schools, which are sort of a hybrid between private and public. And then from the public schools, you're taking about almost 4,000 teacher assistants. There's no pay raise for teachers, as you mentioned. You've got cuts to the Department of Public Instruction, cuts to things that get people into the teaching profession, which I worry about long term. The Republicans, I think, would counter that and say, well, no, we're stepping up Teach for America. But the number of slots there doesn't begin to counter the cuts on the public side. So in the public schools, it's a shift in philosophy. And, you know, I've heard the Republicans say often this session, well, elections have consequences. And people would, I think, agree with that at the end of this session. On the community college side, they probably fared better than the other two systems of education. Their total budget, I think, goes up a little bit, but the tuition per credit hour goes up. And then the university system really got hit. They have some big cuts to deal with and a difference in philosophy there, too, in terms of strategic direction. So, you know, it's sort of if you look at which of those three systems got the worst situation out of the budget, probably university systems the worst, public schools second, and then community colleges third.
We're talking about philosophy. The budget also includes some language, and there's been other legislation this session, to change sort of the mix between private and public and healthcare and economic development and other places. So it's another philosophical move.
That's sort of a theme of the Republican leadership for the most part, is shifting to privatization in everything from vouchers in public schools to privatization in mental health. to taking the Department of Commerce and turning it from a government agency into a public-private partnership, sort of toll roads, maybe toll ferries. All of that is part of a move by the Republicans to put as much, to reduce the role of government and put as much in the private sector. At the end of the day, they'll have to be judged on whether that works or not in terms of stimulating the economy. Our economy, we've still got the fifth highest unemployment rate, and we're not really moving in terms of looking at indexes of economic momentum.
Before we turn to the tax reform plan, I want to ask you one final question about the budget, something that you have talked about a long time, which is passing a budget that spends money and doesn't make policy decisions. Yeah. I think this bill pushes 400 pages, not quite, I think. And there clearly are policy changes that have never passed one chamber, some that haven't passed a committee.
This was a hope I had for the new Republican majority that after complaining together for years about Democrats using what are called special provisions in the budget to change laws unrelated to the budget. You know, it's 394-page budget. I checked my novels last night, and this is As Long as Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. It has major changes. It basically ends teacher tenure by 2018, implements a lot of the Excellent Schools Act, the sort of permission to turn the Department of Commerce into a public-private partnership is in the budget bill rather than a separate bill where it started. Lots and lots of special provisions. So I'm really disappointed that those of us who've complained about that for 15 or 20 years under the Democrats see this continue under the Republicans.
One final question about that. For folks who are listening who aren't involved in this day to day and don't keep up with it, why is it such a troubling practice to do that?
Well, it's because things that couldn't pass on their own end up passing as part of the budget because nobody wants to unravel 394 pages of agreement when they're in the final 3 days of the session and everybody is tired, hot, and wants to go home. I think, too, it's a way to get things passed with less debate, less public scrutiny. I mean, we'll be looking at that budget for days after they've left town, you know, finding things that where the provision in the budget may just say GS-108-685 is repealed. And then you have to look that up. And then lo and behold, you find out some major decision was made. So it's lack of public scrutiny, lack of time for the public to know what's being done, no debate in the public, and probably worst of all, things passing in the budget as special provisions that wouldn't pass on their own if they were just proposed as a straight-up vote as a separate bill.
Let's move to tax reform, which dominated the debate for quite a while in the General Assembly. As the lawmakers came to town, there were all sorts of promises about remaking the tax code, dramatically broadening the sales tax base, maybe lowering some rates. The governor pledged to keep the plan revenue neutral, but as in the final analysis, things ended up much differently than they began.
Yeah, this is not tax reform. This is a tax cut. In terms of what was being talked about at the start of the session, you do have a need for major changes in the tax structure to adjust the tax structure to the new economy. Services are a good example of that. They're probably a huge amount of all retail sales, not just goods, but of services. And the state doesn't pick that part of the economy up. It's the fastest growing part of the economy. The state's old tax structure is premised on manufacturing and sales in stores. That's not a picture of our current economy. They were hoping to get rid of a lot of loopholes and tax credits and deductions and make things fairer and simpler. They made a little progress there, but not enough to call it tax reform. And this is something I think the media hasn't covered as much. I think the media's been sort of intent on giving you the exact numbers that the personal income tax will go down or the corporate income tax will go down. The biggest change is a change in philosophy, to go back to your earlier point. Our philosophy in most states and in the country has been to have a graduated income tax that's premised on the assumption the more money you make, the more taxes, the higher rates you pay. This bill and tax changes in North Carolina switches to a flat tax. It means if you make $20,000, you'll pay this same rate as you pay at $2 million. And that's a pretty different principle of fairness in people's minds. I think more needs to be said about that. You mentioned revenue neutral. The governor in his State of the State only mentioned five words about what he wanted in a final tax plan. He said, repeal the estate tax, which they did. And he said, I want one to be revenue neutral, to produce the same amount of revenue as that the system would produce now. And instead, you've got $500 million short in the first year of the biennium or tax plan. And then you're short about $2.4 billion over a five-year period. That's not revenue neutral. So this, you know, this is disturbing in terms of the governor backing off of what I thought was a very good principle to start from for tax reform, and in turning sort of the goals of the reform effort at the start into really a large tax cut. And then we're getting, you know, it's sort of the battle of the fiscal analysis in terms of who benefits from the tax cut. The Republicans and the Democrats got analysis from fiscal research on, you know, well, who gets the benefit of the tax cut and how many people are in those tax brackets. But it looks like a tax shift from the middle class and poor to the wealthy. I think the next set of analysis needs to look at, okay, of these scenarios that are being done, how many taxpayers are in these different brackets? Is it 80% in this bracket and 20% in the other? Or is it a bell curve or whatever? But regardless of that finding on whether there's a substantial tax shift, my guess is there is. There's some of the major goals of tax reform have not been met.
I want to ask you about a couple other issues, but you mentioned the governor several times. We're almost at the end of his first, at the end of his first legislative session. What did you make of the relationship, which didn't seem nearly as maybe cozy as people had originally thought?
Well, you know, sort of having been at this a while, I think people overestimate sometimes the partisan factor and underestimate the institutional factor, that there's a huge natural rivalry between the executive branch, the governor, and the legislative branch. There's also a huge natural rivalry, regardless of who's in power and who the leaders are, between the House and the Senate. They're just different animals. The governor, I think, had trouble deciding when to be involved and how much to be involved. Part of that's natural. The legislative Republicans have been in power 2 years longer than he has. They knew what they wanted to do day one. He was still sort of learning the job. Then once he realized that they were a full train full speed ahead, when he decided to get involved, he sort of backed off some substantial promises or principles that he made. I mentioned one already in terms of asking that the tax plan be revenue neutral. He said he wouldn't sign or any bills with new abortion restrictions. Backed off both of those. When push came to shove, he tended to ally more with the House, which was the less conservative of the two. Now, all three of these are conservative actors, so it's degrees, the Senate being, I think, the most conservative by far, then the House, and then the governor. When the governor had to find an ally, he would usually ally with the House. But he wanted a tax plan, and so he backed off his revenue neutral request. He wanted to sort of get abortion behind him, and I think agreed to an abortion bill that, if somebody had described it in the campaign, he would have said, no, that does restrict abortion. I won't sign that. And then you've got the dynamic of, for sure, the Speaker of the House, Tom Tillis, running for the U.S. Senate, possibly the leader of the Senate, Phil Berger, the president pro tem, also running for the U.S. Senate. And just different backgrounds. Berger's from a very rural county, Rockingham County. Tillis is from Charlotte, a former IBMer. The governor, McCrory, is a former mayor of Charlotte. Very urban-oriented, and that shows in his budget. I think this budget, one of the untold stories of this budget, will likely be that rural areas really got hit. And a lot of the Republican legislators in these rural areas got hit. Whether it's Burke County, where you've got a major Western Youth Correctional Center closing, four prisons in rural areas closing, a lot of historic sites with cuts, the funding for the Rural Economic Development Center ended. That's probably an untold tale, and a lot of those districts are represented by Republican legislators. So I think the governor, in a way, was learning the job, figuring out how to work with a legislature, even though it was the same party. And meanwhile, you've got this dynamic going on of the U.S. Senate race hovering over everything, and the jockeying that that causes for who's going to be the next speaker. So all of that going on at the same time. It was a three-ring circus where there was something going in every ring.
I wanted to ask you, as we wind it up, about all the national attention that came to North Carolina, the New York Times editorial that talked about North Carolina's decline, the Moral Monday protests where 3,000 to 4,000 people the last few Mondays, which also got a national attention, and the governor talking about North Carolina's brand. What did you make of all that mix and what that means to the state?
Well, Rob Christensen of the News and Observer wrote a very good column about this, I thought, where part of McCrory's run for governor was saying we need to rebrand, that state government is broken, and that the state needs to rebrand itself in order to attract industry and get people to move here and get the economy moving. At the same time, the Republican legislature is making decisions that cause the Moral Mondays to build in terms of number of demonstrators, in terms of number of people arrested. And so you've got two pictures. You've got sort of the picture that the governor is trying to paint of North Carolina as being attractive to business, of lowering taxes to rates as low as surrounding states, except for Tennessee, which doesn't have an income tax, and of trying to redo the Department of Commerce and make things more efficient. So that's one picture being painted. On this easel over here is a second picture, and that's of every Monday night, demonstrators and arrest, sort of the year of the undo, where Republicans saying, yes, elections have consequences, are undoing, 20 years worth of Democratic initiatives. And that causes the New York Times to write this editorial on the decline of North Carolina, I think was one title for it. On the other hand, the Wall Street Journal yesterday just praised the state for its tax package. Those are kind of expected, the Wall Street Journal being more of a Republican-lined media organization, New York Times more democratically aligned. But regardless of which editorial you like, those are competing pictures of a state, and people from the outside are looking at both of those, or they're more focused on one and making decisions on them. And I think the other thing that this plays into is Republicans tend to believe that tax decisions are what motivate industries to move to a state. And in terms of recruiting industry, every study I've seen says that's a factor, but it's also education, it's quality of life, arts, things like that. It's the environment, water, what natural resources they need, transportation, arteries, that taxes are one factor among many. That's going to be interesting to see in the long run if the taxes are such a motivator that our economy just takes off. That proof will be in the pudding.
Well, Rand, as always, I wish you had more time. I really appreciate your analysis, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Up next, the state's job picture, and will the tax reform package really help? Stay tuned.